Welcome to On Demand with Jenna Ellis. This is the exclusive AFR podcast that we answer your questions and do deep dives on demand. And what you are most interested in learning about this week, according to the response that I got, and also from Jerry in Mississippi, he asked this question: what's going on with the war in Ukraine? Why don't we have more footage coming out from the war like we do basically everything else in this digital era? And Jerry, that's a really great question. And I think there's a lot of questions we could add to that. Like, why is the United States spending so much money, sending money and then loans now, about a $20 billion loan or $50 billion, something like that. I'm losing track of all of the billions, and I think Joe Biden is too. But, you know, this loan that, as Trump rightly says, will never be repaid to the U.S., so it's not really a loan. This is fooling no one, and yet the Biden administration appears to be determined to continue provoking this war well before Trump even takes office. And provoked is actually the title of a brand new book with my guest today, Scott Horton. So Provoked: How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. So Scott, I think you're the perfect person to break this all down. So your book Provoked is available now on Amazon. But let's start at the very beginning. I mean, how did we even get here?
Well, thank you, first of all, Jenna, so much for having me on your show. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your audience here. Basically, just like everything else in the world, it's all Bill Clinton's fault, although, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than that. But essentially, the truth is that at the end of the last Cold War, well, let me go back, because who knows who's in your audience? Probably have some young people in your audience, maybe went to government school and nobody told them anything. Well, I'll tell you this. In the Second World War, it was America and Britain and France in the West and the Soviet Union in the East against Nazi Germany in the middle. The Soviets were our allies in the Second World War. But then they conquered all of Eastern Europe in order to get to Germany, right, on the way to Germany to win the war. But they were ruled by the evil communist dictator Joseph Stalin, who kept all that territory. And he either forced those countries to be so-called republics in the Soviet Union, or at least had sock puppet communist governments that ruled their countries, forced them to be part of the Soviet military alliance, which was called the Warsaw Pact. So all of Eastern Europe, from halfway across Germany all the way to Russia, that was all commie territory from World War II, which ended in 1945, through 1989, through about 1991. When the Soviet Union unraveled at the end of the Ronald Reagan years and during the reign of President George Bush Sr., who was president from 1989 through 1993. Okay, so what happened was, as the Soviet Union fell apart, George Bush Sr. promised the Soviets that if they would allow German reunification and they would withdraw their troops from Germany, that America would keep Germany in our NATO alliance, and America would neutralize Germany. They threatened the Soviets. They said, you don't want Germany to be independent and get nuclear weapons, do you? So let us keep our NATO alliance in Germany, but we promise not to expand any further east than that. Now, the war party will tell you that's not true, but they're lying or they're just ignorant and wrong. I demonstrate this thoroughly in my book, and many other great researchers and scholars and so forth before me have as well. They absolutely promised they would not take advantage of Soviet withdrawal from Eastern Europe by integrating the new Eastern European countries into America's military alliance. You let Germany reunify, and we promise to call it quits there. Now, honestly, Bush Sr. was lying in the first place. He knew that he was just telling them what he had to tell them to get them to acquiesce and get them to back off in Eastern Europe. But he knew that the plan all along was to expand American influence into Eastern Europe, where the Soviets were. Now, when Bill Clinton came to town, he picked up that same policy. And essentially, so if everybody can just picture a map of Europe in your head here for a minute, as best as you have one, government school graduates here, you have all these countries that used to be dominated by the Soviet communists. Many of them now wanted to hide behind America's skirt. right, and say, well, America, we want to be part of your alliance too, because everybody knows the Russians won't try it if we're part of the American military alliance, have a war guarantee from the American superpower. So it makes sense that Poland and the Baltics and Hungary and Czechoslovakia, or then the Czech Republic, would want to join. Of course they would. But the question was, is this a good idea for America to do? And importantly, it wasn't just people like Ron Paul and Pat Buchanan who were very skeptical of American interventionism on the right, but it was actually even the mainstream consensus in the 1990s among the foreign policy establishment was, we should not do this. We are essentially on a path to just humiliating the Russians and provoking a reaction out of the Russians, and we're not really getting anything for it. And they're not really a danger to our friends in Poland or the Baltics at this point anyway. The USSR was just completely wrecked. There was nothing left of it. They had no offensive military force. There was no enemy to have an ally against. But they kept expanding NATO anyway. And that's the core of it. There's also the color-coded revolutions, which Bill Clinton started, but W. Bush certainly continued. And Obama did the biggest one. Bush did the Orange Revolution in 2004 in Ukraine. Obama did it 10 years later with the Maidan Revolution, which was absolutely sponsored by the USA. It was essentially a coup. I don't speak French. There's all different kinds of coups. It was a coup de something or other. It was a right-wing street putsch, essentially, against the democratically elected president, who had already agreed to early elections and was sure to lose them and lose power. But they ran him out of town with violence, and then America supported that, and that was what led in 2014 to the loss of the Crimean Peninsula to Russia, and then eventually the outbreak of the civil war in the east of that country. Now, Jenna, the point is here that is really worth emphasizing to me, I think, is, again, about how much of the American foreign policy establishment, and I mean Republicans and Democrats, knew better before they went ahead and did it anyway. And that's what my book is. 775,000 words of just Americans saying, boy, we better not do this stupid thing we're about to do, and then doing it. And it's time after time after time. And one of the greatest examples of this is at the end of the W. Bush era, in the last year, in 2008, all of the consensus, never even mind in the magazines and the newspapers and the think tanks, but literally inside the W. Bush administration, the entire National Security Council, or the Russia experts, their division of the National Security Council in the White House, the ambassador and all of the embassy staff in Moscow, the CIA and the National Intelligence Council, which is the rest of the intelligence agencies, they all warned W. Bush not to invite Ukraine into NATO. And now, this is somewhat famous, but it's not famous enough. So let me tell you. Our current CIA director, William Burns, was at that time W. Bush's ambassador to Russia. And Burns wrote Condoleezza Rice a memo that is published at WikiLeaks. Anyone can read it. It's from February of 2008. And it's called Niet Means Niet. And it's Burns reporting to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice that he's just met with every wonk in Moscow, in and out of government, from all different political parties and everything, and he says, this place is going to go bananas if we invite Ukraine into NATO. We just can't do it. This is an absolutely crucial country to Russia for so many reasons, and it could very well cause a war. And they told me, hey, this could cause a war. Please don't put us in this position, because if it does, we could have to intervene in there, and we don't want to do that. We'd rather just leave things how they are. This is what Burns told Rice. And then he wrote in his memoir that he thought that Condoleezza Rice agreed with him. And, Jenna, we know that Secretary of Defense Robert Gates agreed, because he wrote it about it in his memoir, and he slammed Bush for ignoring their sound advice. He goes after him for it, his own sitting Secretary of Defense. So you had the entire government, not just, as I said, the NSC and the CIA and all of the advisors and the wonks and the embassy staff, but literally you had the director, the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense also didn't want to do it. And you know what Burns says in his memoir? He says, but W. Bush did it anyway. And you know why? Legacy building for himself. See, this is what libertarians call public choice theory. It means there is no national interest. There's just the individual interests of the boobs in charge up there doing what they think is best for themselves. And so even the entire, and W. Bush had a pretty hawkish government, if anyone remembers. They were not wilting lilies. But his own government said this is so unwise. The French and the Germans did everything they could to talk him out of it. And he didn't give them a full membership action plan. But he announced that they would be members one day, which is essentially announcing a membership action plan, still not giving them a war guarantee, but putting the Russians on notice that if you want to do something about this to stop us, you better get started. And that was exactly what happened. It's just absolute horrible diplomacy. And quite frankly, too, let me address real quick before I finally stop talking for a minute, is for your audience who thinks that I just love Russia or something because they never heard something like this before, I'll tell you, just so you know, because you don't know me, your people don't know me, I'm a Texan, and I'm a Ron Paul guy, and I am an anti-interventionist, and I don't care about Russia at all. I don't know any Russians. I ain't never been there. I ain't got no friends and family from there. I don't have any interest there whatsoever, and quite frankly, I don't even think there are really many pro-Russianists or pro-Putinists anywhere in America, including among the Russian diaspora. Have you ever heard, you know, back in the old days, you literally had American communists who sided with the Soviet Union because they were communists. But there's just nothing parallel to that. Remember the big scare story, this ridiculous story about Trump as a Nazi because he held a rally at Madison Square Garden, which is, of course, the most important venue in the most important city in the world. But anyway, and they said, oh, but in 1939, the German-American Bund held a rally there, too. Well, anyway, I'm only bringing that up to say there is no Russian-American Bund, is there? Nobody cares about Putin. Nobody's loyal to, loves Russia, sides with Russia. I don't speak Russian. I don't go to RussianTalkingPoints.com to get what to say here. I got all of my stuff out of government documents in the New York Times. I say 8,000 citations in my book. Everyone can read them. None of them are Russian propaganda. None of what I'm saying is because I want anyone to sympathize with Russia at all. I'm only telling the truth about how lousy our politicians are and what terrible choices they've made and how they caused this terrible problem to happen. And that's not the same as attacking America. It's just not. Because Bill Clinton, the face-biting rapist, scumbag, psychopath, liar, lunatic, is not America. He's just actually like the very worst of us, right? Bill Clinton should have been in the penitentiary before he ever had a chance to run for president. So how could it be that we are all somehow completely gay married to every decision he ever made? And if anyone criticizes it, that's criticizing America. It's just not the case. And you could say the same thing about W. Bush and Barack Obama, too, that these are and look, here's a funny way to say it, I guess. It's basically our situation is like if Joe Biden had not plagiarized that speech and had to drop out in 88, and somehow Joe Biden had won the election of 88, and we've had President Biden this whole time. That's basically the situation. We've had bad leadership. And that's not a condemnation of our country, but of our politicians and our political system. I hope that's clear.
Yeah, wow, what a history lesson. And I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who is the director of the Libertarian Institute, the editorial director of antiwar.com, and his book is called Provoked: How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. And this is a brand new book. You can get it at Amazon, anywhere books are sold. And I would highly recommend that people understand, you know, this history, because I think that where we're at in this moment is that people really think that this is just Biden's war. And as much as I would love to blame everything on Bill Clinton and, you know, some of the Democrats in the 90s, I mean, what you're describing about Bush and Bush Sr., I mean, this seems like a classic example of the uniparty swamp that is in D.C., and really no distinction here, especially when it comes to pro-war and pro, quote-unquote, spreading democracy policies that end up with no real clear American interest, that there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans until you get to Donald Trump. And this is why he was such a disruptor in D.C. And so, you know, fast forward then to the first Trump administration, when he comes on scene, you know, in early 2017 in the White House, how did that change this posture?
Well, I mean, isn't it something? Because as everyone remembers, and I have about 75 pages on this in my book, the gigantic, absolutely insane, fraudulent Russiagate hoax where, I mean, you couldn't make this up. If we didn't all live through it, if I didn't know for a fact that your audience remembers this well, I would be afraid to say it because it makes me sound crazy. But it's just that's how crazy it was. The CIA and the FBI and the Democrats and the British framed a major party presidential candidate for the presidency of the United States for treason with Russia, for being a Manchurian candidate, a blackmailed, suborned agent, spy of compromised tool of the Kremlin, which is the worst thing. I mean, God, especially in a previous era, he could have been hanged or something over this. I mean, this is like the worst thing that you could falsely accuse somebody of being. And then he got the nomination and they kept it up. And then he won the presidency, and then they continued to pretend to investigate him for 2 more years. And they said, remember, guys, they tried to brief the Electoral College. They had tried to have the CIA tell the Electoral College they should throw it to the House of Representatives so they could give it to Hillary, or if not her, at least to Paul Ryan or Colin Powell or anyone but Trump. Can you imagine? Then they tried to use the 25th Amendment to say he was a foreign spy, so to have his own cabinet overthrow him. And then they knew that wouldn't work. And so then the FBI told CNN, well, we can't overthrow him through the 25th Amendment. Notice they're not talking about impeaching him and removing him because they have no charges. There's nothing to impeach him for. The whole thing is completely made up. It's completely fake. So they go, well, then at least what we can do is we can keep the investigation going to rein him in. That's the quote, to rein him in, to prevent him from having his own independent Russia policy. And by the way, if you go back to the beginning of the Obama years, what did Obama say? Obama and Hillary said, we want to reset. W. Bush just screwed up everything, especially in his last year in power. But that was how Obama won, was by renouncing everything Bushian. So he said, let's have a big reset. Let's try to get along with Russia. They didn't say that was high treason. In fact, rewind 8 years before that, W. Bush came in and said, you know, Bill Clinton screwed up everything with Yeltsin. But now we got this new guy, Putin, and I'm the new guy, and it's a new century. So maybe we can have a reset and get along. So Trump is not outside the norm here at all. Everybody keeps trying to get along with the Russians before they screw them over and end up causing a problem. But Trump was the same way, but essentially just to try to rig the game, to cheat, to rig the election for Hillary Clinton was where it all originated with John Brennan. And so that absolutely hemmed in Donald Trump's policy. And people can find this article at the New York Times. It's by a guy named Keith Gessen. And he says in there, he quotes someone from Trump's own NSC who says, well, Trump is like the captain of a ship. He's holding a wheel, but it's not attached to anything, right? And in fact, I'll refer your audience, another touchstone that your audience will remember very well, is during the impeachment of Donald Trump. I can't even believe I'm saying this. It makes me sound like I'm crazy, like I'm from some parallel dimension where absolute craziness took hold. But no, this really happened. They impeached the president of the United States of America for the third time in history for temporarily holding up an arms shipment to Ukraine. And then, in fact, the arms got there in time, and there never was any kind of quid pro quo or extortion or anything about it. And he had every right to call every shot about whether we're transferring arms to Ukraine as a president of the United States. Are you kidding me? And then, but what happened? Remember what happened? Some lowly schmuck lieutenant colonel, a Ukrainian American who is somehow an American Army officer sitting on the U.S. National Security Council down the hall from Donald Trump, just lied. He embellished what Trump had said to the president of Ukraine far beyond reason and turned it into this ridiculous conspiracy. And you read his testimony. He says Trump was trying to
Vidman,
force
right?
Ukraine.
Alexander Vidman?
Go ahead.
You're talking about Vidman?
Yeah, that's right. Alexander Vidman.
Yeah.
He says Trump was trying to force Ukraine to launch a criminal investigation, essentially that he must have known, that we all can just assume Trump must have known would have been based on completely false accusations against the 100% innocent Joe Biden. And so therefore, this is an absolutely criminal attempt to suborn a foreign government, extort a foreign government into intervening in an American election. So he had to do the right thing and tell the truth about it. So he gave the report to his buddy, the CIA officer, who was another John Brennan guy. It was Brennan who had placed Vindman on the Security Council in the first place, the same guy who invented Russiagate in the first place, former leader of Al-Qaeda in Syria, but that's another interview. And so Cherumella then was the whistleblower who... supposed whistleblower who got the whole impeachment kicked off. But then what did Vindman say at his testimony in front of the U.S. Congress? Anyone can read it, and anyone can also read his long article that he wrote in The Atlantic magazine, where Vindman says, in no uncertain terms, Jenna, that we, the U.S. government, we, the interagency, we have a Russia policy, and we have a Ukraine policy. And this SOB Donald Trump, whoever that is, thought that he had the right to change America's foreign policy. Who does he think he is? Not Vindman, Trump. Who does Trump, the winner of the election, to sit behind that desk? Who does he think he is to tell me, a lieutenant colonel on the National Security Council, what American foreign policy is? He has no right to do that. And when he tried to change our government's policy, well, I knew he had to be stopped, because otherwise, something, his opinion, it would be bad for Ukraine. In other words, this is pure insubordination by a guy who's 10 ranks below the president, doesn't have the slightest authority whatsoever to question any of this, and had to absolutely lie and embellish the conversation beyond any reason to turn it into something criminal. And then the Democrats, literally in control of the House of Representatives, impeached him. They did impeach him and hold a trial in the Senate.
I remember that. I was on the legal team for that impeachment. I was on the legal team for that impeachment, and, I'd, of course, come.
Oh, really? Well, you were there.
Oh, yeah. I was very much there for, for all of this, and the whole, Russia collusion nonsense, and, the Mueller investigation,
well, so how did I
all
do then,
of that.
Jenna? Was I pretty good?
Oh, yeah. And this is just, it's proving and showing how, Vindman, in my opinion, it was this kind of how dare you as the sitting president change the policy of how the swamp operates and how the uniparty wants to persist, and how dare you come in and think that you can actually enact policies according to, your mandate from the voters who maybe don't like how Washington works. And it was and it was this kind of this manifested outrage that showed so clearly what Donald Trump had said during his very first campaign, which was that we need to drain the swamp. And I'm convinced, Scott, that Vindman wasn't even just speaking for himself. I mean, he was speaking on behalf of his higher-ups, who basically said, you report to us, not the current sitting president, who constitutionally is the commander-in-chief, but, you report to this bureaucracy, otherwise your career is going to be ended. And they did try to impeach him for it. And I'm convinced as well that, it would have been something else, because the day that Mueller testified and just the whole Russia collusion hoax was absolutely dead in the water, the very next day was when that phone call with Zelensky took place that they impeached him over. He could have ordered a pizza that day.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was the next day. They could have, Trump could have ordered a pizza to the White House. They would have impeached him over it, over something, because they needed a new narrative. And this played in perfectly with exactly how they wanted to take him down. And of course, that impeachment took over the entire narrative until we got to the COVID narrative, right? And so it was just back to back to back ways to try to take him out. And so what actually changed, though, in terms of the posture of the United States with this kind of Cold War and Trump's dealings with Putin over his 4 years, and then because then we get to Biden taking over in 2021.
Mm-hmm. Well, so really nothing changed during Trump, and that's the sad truth. If he had enough loyal allies with him, and if he had really taken an interest to study the problem and exactly what they needed to do about it, and if he had somehow been able to bat down the Russiagate hoax earlier or something, possibly he could have done things different. But I think it was really ultimately just not up to him for the most part. I guess he gave in under pressure and escalated arms. Obama had sold some arms, but Trump sent even more, and it was a mistake. And there was a peace deal that had been signed in February of 2015, which the French and the Germans negotiated with the Ukrainians and the Russians. But Obama put his rubber stamp on it, and the UN Security Council put their rubber stamp on it. It was supposed to be official, but Obama never insisted and certainly never helped the government to implement the deal then. And the Trump government, I don't know whether he ever even had a policy on this, whether his people ever talked to him about it or how this went. But for 4 years, his government certainly never put pressure on Kiev to implement the Minsk II deal. And they could have done that. They would have probably had to provide protection for him first for Poroshenko. Zelensky didn't come in until 19. But first for Poroshenko and then for Zelensky. They might have needed some Blackwater bodyguards or something, because there's some dangerous people out there to their right who would be willing to and have openly declared that they would kill any president who dared to negotiate with the Russians. So, but there were things that could have been done for America to implement a peace deal that would have prevented the worst of the war from breaking out in the Biden years, almost certainly. But as I say, his own people bragged that they had simply just seized the power away from him. And so he can only be held partially responsible for that. If he'd been a little bit better at seizing control over those issues, he may have been able to force his way. But that was how it played out. And then when Biden came in, it was as though, you know, he had won in 16 and was picking up right where he and Obama had left off before. Pardon me, I'm going to mute to cough for just 1 second.
Yeah, well, and while you're doing that, too, I mean, it really was that. I mean, it was almost like they just wanted to somehow, you know, completely black hole Trump's 4 years and just go right back to the era of, you know, the Rhino Republicans that are so pro-war and the hawks and everything that the Democrats want. And so, you know, fast forwarding a little bit, and I don't want to get too far ahead because I want to go back to, you know, what Biden did. But, you know, can Trump with this knowledge now, and I think he's coming in with a lot more of an eyes open, can he do more now in these next 4 years than he was able to accomplish? Because I've said, and I said when I worked for him, he was the most underserved president by his own staff, who did what they thought was the Washington mandate instead of the mandate of the person actually sitting in the chair behind the desk in the Oval. But, you know, I think that he's hopefully surrounding himself with people who get that this time.
Yes, I think he will be a much stronger leader this time. He's not going to let the Justice Department bog him down in some phony investigations. On the other hand, he does make bad calls sometimes. He could make mistakes that open himself up to further persecution. But certainly to start here, he's going to have his 100 days. They're not going to take that away from him. And it'll be an uphill battle. But, yes, he's got Congress with him, and he's got – you know, clearly in the election, it wasn't just the Democrats that lost the election. It was left cultural hegemony that also lost the election. So, you know, people can say various F words again without losing their job, whatever it is. And you know, that whole kind of era, that zeitgeist of leftist, wokist cultural dominance has kind of come to an end, I think. Not even kind of. I think it's really been taken a real beating here in the last election. And so I think the momentum is with him to do what it is he thinks is best for a while anyway. And on this particular issue, he does seem very intent on bringing peace. And, you know, I don't know if your people have ever heard this before, but, or maybe you've talked to him about this. I'm sorry, I didn't realize how close to him you are, but
no worries.
He has said repeatedly that he's terrified of nuclear war. He had an uncle that taught at MIT, who was the most brilliant scientist, the most magnificent scientist who ever scientisted at MIT. And he taught Trump what an H-bomb really does. And Trump got properly afraid of hydrogen bomb warfare in a way that most people are not educated enough to understand. And he has brought that up over and over again, that how could we risk, how could we even slightly raise the risk of nuclear war over something that is just not that important to us, like the sovereignty over who controls the Donbass, and especially when this is all America's fault. You know, if George W. Bush and Barack Obama hadn't done what they'd done, we'd never had this situation in the first place. That is a mitigating factor. We have to take that into account. It's not just that Putin woke up one day and decided that he wanted to do this. And by I left out Biden's first year there. That goes on the list as well. He didn't just wake up and say, I want to rebuild the Soviet Union. That's all propaganda. What he's doing is he's trying to resolve a terrible boiling border dispute that's been going on for almost a decade that America touched off here. And so it doesn't make him right. The book is called Provoked, not Justified. I think there are plenty of other ways that he could have approached solving this problem besides the way that he did. I'm not saying that he had no choice, but I am saying that it's literally the American presidents and their men's fault as much as it is his, or, you know, call it 49-51, because they put him in the position, certainly, where he thought it was now or never. He's got no choice. They're going to make him have a war sooner or later, so better sooner, before they're even more armed than they already are. And, in fact, here's a great anecdote for you, too, from the early Biden times, right before the war. There's a reporter named Zach Dorfman from Yahoo News, and he had a great series about the CIA in Ukraine, really in-depth stuff. The New York Times, you know, plagiarized him 3 years later or 2 years later and pretended that he'd never existed, but it's good stuff. And so Dorfman wrote in Yahoo News that he was talking with the CIA officers in Ukraine who were the ones receiving the weapons and distributing them to the Ukrainian government. That was their job. And they complained to him that from their position on the ground there, they knew, and they warned their bosses, and they begged their bosses to tell the politicians, to warn the White House, that we're not deterring Russia with these weapons. We are provoking them. We're not giving Ukraine enough weapons. What exactly would it be? What's the magic formula to give them the right amount and the right kind of weapons that Russia would say, oops, we missed our window, now we can never do it? Because that's what the position you would have to put them in. No one knows how to put them exactly in that position. And instead, what have we done? We've gave Ukraine enough weapons that now they're actually really dangerous. Maybe not as an invasion force against Russia, but certainly to continue the civil war in the East indefinitely. And as the stronger they get, the more they'll be able to prevent Russia from ever being able to do anything about that. And so it's like they put his back to a wall. Maybe not all the way in the corner, but if you put a guy's back to the wall, he might go ahead and hit you before you got him all the way in the corner. And that's essentially what Joe Biden did. And by the way, too, and I know your audience will pick right up on this, too. Everybody can see this about Joe Biden. He's not smart enough and sophisticated enough to be a good enough liar. He wears his own stupid thought processes right on his sleeve, written all over his face. And you listen to him talk. He says, I'm Winston Churchill facing down Hitler. The last thing you ever want to be is Neville Chamberlain, who appeases Hitler. You always got to be Churchill and Roosevelt, who face down Hitler, because he doesn't really know anything. So he has this comic book sort of superficial, mythology, the true founding mythology of America now. George Washington, even Abraham Lincoln are long gone now. It's FDR and Truman are the true founding fathers now. And the lesson of FDR and Truman is always fight. Never give in to anyone ever on anything, because everything is always their fault. Everyone else is always Hitler, and you can never appease them, because that only makes them stronger. And they can never accept that there are other conflicts in the world that aren't necessarily Hitlerian conflicts. And there are other conflicts in the world where actually looks like they've been trying to appease us, and it's not working, only emboldening our side. So what about that? And they can never look at it from any point of view. Joe Biden, I think, is a perfect exemplar of the decrepit, decaying American empire right now and their mindset. You know, I begin my book with a quote from him saying, if not America, who would lead the world? You see the self-justification in everything they do that's baked into that. If you know that you're Christopher Reeve, Superman, saving a kitten from a tree, and that every enemy you ever face is Lex Luthor, then you can never be wrong. right? Just like George W. Mm-hmm. Bush invoking Jesus to go to war in the Middle East, or for that matter, Osama bin Laden invoking Muhammad to go to war against the West. Once you know you're right and you're not listening anymore, you're bound to make some pretty bad mistakes.
Yeah, well, Scott, you know, and this is all such a fascinating history, and I'm really excited to read your book. And of course, you know, this book, Provoked, that you can buy on Amazon or anywhere else that books are sold, and get, you know, even more of a deep dive. I want to ask you as well, because, you know, people who kind of see the whole Ukraine thing a little bit in a vacuum, because a lot of people didn't even know who Zelensky was until the whole impeachment drama and all of this. There has been this sort of floating theory, maybe conspiracy theory out there, that a lot of this funding for Ukraine that came in under Biden was potentially a quid pro quo or a payment to Zelensky for essentially cooperating with the first impeachment. Do you address that in your book, or do you give any, you know, kind of light on that whole maybe sidetrack, or is there any, do you think, credibility to that?
No, I don't address that in the book. And frankly, I think that's like too oversimplified, just, you know, a direct payoff. Like, in other words, if America is pouring tens of millions of dollars and billions even into Ukraine, if I say tens of millions, that was just a verbal typo. We're pouring tens and even hundreds of billions of dollars in there. Zelensky's going
to
have
millions, billions, trillions.
Right?
Doesn't
Biden,
even matter
Biden
to Lindsey Graham
to
at this point. But yeah,
that he's getting a particular payment. That's going to be taken care of there. It really is much more a larger policy-based thing. And essentially, you know, the Ukrainians need us. So then that means they're on the hook for, you know, as much as we're willing to give them or not at any given time, and all those kinds of things.
Well,
so,
and as we're kind of running out of time here, Scott,
go ahead.
I want to ask you as well, because we only have about 5 minutes left here, and I appreciate, you know, this deep dive. So how much is Trump going to have to contend with, you know, these kind of Bushian rhinos in the GOP in his next term? Because we know that there are some genuine America First patriots that want to fulfill the Trump agenda. Certainly, you know, his nominees all seem to point that direction. But how much is the GOP itself going to be an obstacle to especially this issue come January of next year?
Well, that's a really great question. It does go back to your previous question, too, about how much of a stronger, you know, wheel and spoke type of a president is he going to be this time compared to looser control the last time, and what his choices are. You know, he tends to play tough guy, but then try to make peace in a way that, if your older audience will know the phrase, only Nixon can go to China. That's because if anyone else went to China, Nixon would have called him a commie. But Nixon can go and even shake hands with Mao Zedong to break China away from the Soviet Union. 17 years before the fall of the Soviet Union, America had already ended the Cold War with communist China. And only Nixon could have pulled that off. And I think, quite frankly, Donald Trump, Mr. President, if you're listening, he could just go directly to Moscow, to Beijing, to Tehran, to Pyongyang, and say, look, I'm the tallest, wealthiest, most successful president since Abraham Lincoln, and look at how wonderful I am, and I ain't afraid of no Ayatollah. Let's make a deal, Ayatollah. Sit down and work it out. America has nothing to fear from Iran or from North Korea. Iran, I mean, they don't even have nuclear weapons. North Korea certainly does. But Donald Trump has already proven that he can break into a solid handshake with Kim Jong-un and that they can sit down at a table and deal. Just don't bring John Bolton or his equivalent with you next time, sir. We need it. And when the Washington Post and all the Democrats accuse him of appeasing Vladimir Putin, then that means the American right, the MAGA America First right, they need to have his back and say, no, this isn't about doing for Russia. This is about doing the right thing for the United States of America, which is, includes, of course, avoiding conflict with Russia. We don't care what Democrats say about that. Has nothing to do. They say, oh, he loves dictators so much. Well, maybe because they're easy to negotiate with. They don't have to have Congress to deal with or something. But otherwise, that's not true. He's an American patriot and nationalist, whether you agree with them or disagree with them about this, that, or the other issue. It is just a fraud to say that he's on the side of any other country. Well, maybe Israel, but certainly not Iran, Russia, North Korea, or any of these so-called adversary states, China, any of these so-called adversary states of the United States. So that means he ought to be able to do like Nixon, can go to China, and he ought to go to China too, and everywhere else. He'd be Trump the Great. He could start off his new presidency by just solving America's permanent crisis with the four or five major powers we got a problem, or major nations that we have a problem with in the world. And then what? And then we can all just get rich and be free. How about that? Abandon
well,
the empire.
Hey, I
we
think
don't
that's
need it
how
there's no enemy out there to fight.
Right. That's how much Trump does want to make America great again. And I think you're right, you know, that on his allyship with Israel. And that's definitely a good thing for America's interests. But, you know, Scott, we got to leave it here. I mean, there's so much more that I would want to unpack with you. And I hope that you'll join us again, maybe for round two on the podcast, especially after Trump takes office and we kind of see how this goes. But I really appreciate your commentary today and breaking all of this history down. Scott Horton's book is Provoked, How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. Get this book. Hey, great Christmas present, right? So you can get that at Amazon or anywhere books are sold. And so if you have a question or an issue, a topic, a guest that you want to hear here on demand, then you can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. And join us next week for another episode of On Demand.